to join the ranks of those who don't know. I haven't any idea what I'm going to speak on. If you want to get your money's worth, I'd be quite glad to go on for 2.5 hours. Reminds me of the church that wanted a preacher who wouldn't preach very long, and they got this fellow, they went to hear him, he preached for 15 minutes, and they thought, man, that's the man we want. When they got him, first Sunday, he preached for 30 minutes, and they were upset. They thought they'd better keep an eye on him. And the following Sunday, he preached for 3 hours. So they had a little meeting and asked him to explain himself. Well, he said, first Sunday you heard me, I had just had all my teeth out, and my gums were very, very sore. I couldn't preach for more than 15 minutes. And he said, that first Sunday I was with you, I had just got my new dentures, and they didn't fit very good, and they hurt. I could only preach for 30 minutes. Well, he said, we want to know about this time you preached for 3 hours. Well, he said, I'm sorry about that. I got my wife's teeth in by mistake. I told that story up in New Jersey one time, and I didn't know that there was a women's liver in the audience. And she came up afterwards. I thought she was coming up to get saved. Afterwards, I thought she did need to come up to get saved. She bent my ear for about 30 minutes. And I can assure you, she had her own teeth in. Well, we look at a psalm tonight. Let's look at the best known of all the great Hebrew hymns. Let's look at Psalm 23. It's just an absolutely lovely and delightful psalm. It's one we all practically know by heart. When we think of the book of Psalms, we instinctively think of the 23rd psalm, one of the great hymns in the Scottish Psalter. I really like the way the Scottish people sing the psalms. They put them into rhyme and rhythm, and that hymn we sometimes sing based on the 23rd psalm is a classic example of the Scottish Psalter. They have retained the essence and the truth of the psalm, but they've managed to convey it in good English poetry as well. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Thou dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Trust the Holy Spirit will bless the reading of his word to our hearts this evening. There is, of course, a great debate amongst theologians as to whether or not David wrote this psalm when he was a young man or as an old man. There are some who think that David was anticipating his death, and he's looking back over a very rich and full life, and that one of the last things he did before he crossed over Jordan and went on home to heaven was to write this great Hebrew hymn. There are others, and I personally inclined to this view, that David wrote the psalm when he was a very young man, when he was a shepherd out on the Judean hills. I rather like to think that. I like to think that this great Hebrew hymn came from the pen of a teenager. That's quite possible, you know. When Isaac Watts was just a lad, one of the great hymn writers of the Christian church, the English church, he came home one day from church and complained to his father about the stuffy hymns that they sang in church. And his father said, "Well, Isaac, if you can do any better, why don't you?" Well, he said, "I think I will." And he went up to his room, and a little while later he came back down and presented his father with one of the greatest hymns of our hymn book. So it can be done. It can be done by a teenager. David, even as a very young man, knew what it was to walk very close to the Lord. By the way, that hymn that Isaac Watts wrote was "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross on which the Prince of Glory died." Wrote that was just a teenager. But he evidently knew something about God. I like to think that when David went down into the valley of Elah to destroy him that had the power of death, when he went down there alone to come to grips with Goliath of Gath, that as he ran towards that great enemy, he began to sing, and I can just hear him as the sound of his voice awakes the echoes of the valley of the shadow of death. "Yea, though I walk in death's dark vale, yet will I fear no ill, for thou art with me, and thy rod and staff me comfort still." I like to think that. The psalm deals with three things. In the opening part of the psalm, David takes us into the glen. And in the middle of the psalm, he takes us down into the gorge. And then in the closing part of the psalm, he takes us on over into the glory. The three parts of this great Hebrew hymn. The glen, the gorge, and the glory. In the first part of the psalm, he talks about our frailty. In the middle part of the psalm, he talks about our foes. And at the end of the psalm, he talks about our future. Some years ago, my mother went down to Park of the Palms to live. She only was there a month, and she died. She had a massive stroke on a Sunday afternoon and was ushered immediately into glory. Nobody knew what had happened. They went to find out why she hadn't come in for her evening meal and found her lying on the floor. Rushed her off to hospital, but she never recovered. When I went into her room the next day, sitting beside her bedside was the missionary prayer handbook put out by CMML. And since my mother was born and bred in another country, she had beside her American missionary prayer handbook, she had one that was put out by her colleagues in Great Britain. And I noticed that both these prayer handbooks were turned down, page was turned down for tomorrow. That told me that she'd prayed all up to date for today and was all ready for tomorrow. Isn't that a lovely way to die? And she also had by her bedside her Bible, and it was open at Psalm 23. And there was a little piece of paper in her Bible. And it said, "The secret of a happy life. The secret of a happy death. The secret of a happy eternity." I'm going to preach my mother's sermon tonight. Although I'm quite sure that that outline did not originate with her. It was evidently something that was very precious to her and quite obviously something that she had been meditating on that very afternoon. The secret of a happy life, the secret of a happy death, and the secret of a happy eternity. Now, a happy life has its roots in a magnificent spiritual relationship. And it has its results in a magnificent spiritual reality. Here's the magnificent spiritual relationship. The Lord is my shepherd. That's the greatest name for God in the Old Testament. In the King James text, whatever you see the name Lord in capital letters, as perhaps most of you already know, it simply means that in the original text, the word is Jehovah. It was the greatest name for God amongst the Jews. The Jews called it the ineffable name. They wouldn't pronounce it. In the days of Jesus, the name Jehovah had not been used for many, many centuries. They were so afraid of taking the name of Jehovah, their God, in vain, that they changed the name from Jehovah to Adonai. That's what the word Lord is in capital letters. It is where the Jews changed the name, but it's really the name Jehovah. Dr. A.T. Pearson says the name occurs about 10,700 times in the original text of the Old Testament. I've never counted it, but certainly it is a great many, many times. In our King James Bible, you only find the name Jehovah in the Old Testament about 3 or 4 times. Usually it's the word Lord printed in capital letters. But it was the greatest name for God amongst the Jews. In the Newbery Bible, Mr. Newbery tells us that the name is a composite word. It's a transliteration of the three tenses of the Hebrew word to be. Yihai, Ho, and Haya. They took the first syllable of the first word, Yi. The sound of the middle word, Ho. The last syllable of the third word, Yaha. Yi, Ho, Va. The three tenses of the word to be. He will be. He is. He was. All telescoped into one great name for God. The God who is always there. The God who lives in the eternal present tense of time. When we express our mode of being, we express it in three tenses of time. We say, I was, I am, I will be. But God doesn't do that. He says, I am. I am. I am. He doesn't need the past and the present. The past and the future, because he lives in the eternal present. There's no such thing as past, present, and future to a God who transcends all time. He sees everything in the present tense, because that's where he lives. When he gave his name to Moses, he said, I am that I am. He expressed himself as living in the present tense. Now this is the one that David says is his shepherd. He all about sheep to David. He was the great shepherd of the sheep in the Old Testament. He was willing to give his life for the sheep. When he stood before King Saul, he could tell of secret victories in his life. Thy servant, he could say, slew both the lion and the bear. Just a teenage lad, without a high-powered rifle, just a slingshot and a stick in his hand, he had taken a lamb right out of the maw of a lion, and had not hesitated to grapple with a mountain bear in order to save one of his little sheep. And he thinks to himself, now that's what a shepherd does. A shepherd takes care of his sheep. And a wonderful idea dawned upon him one day as he was sitting there strumming with his little harp in his hand, picking out the notes, and this marvelous idea dawned upon him that what he did for sheep, Jehovah did for him. Jehovah, he says, is my shepherd. My shepherd. A magnificent spiritual relationship. It's not enough to acknowledge that he is the shepherd, the good shepherd, the great shepherd, the chief shepherd, anything you like. That's not enough. Have to be able to say, the Lord is my shepherd. Magnificent spiritual relationship. Then there are those magnificent spiritual resources. The secret of a satisfied life I shall not want, he says. The secret of a saved life he brings back. He restoreth. The Hebrew says, he brings back my soul. Secret of a spiritual life, he leadeth me in the paths of righteousness. Secret of a secured life, for his name's sake. A satisfied life I shall not want. David could say later on, I have been young, now I am old, and I've never seen the righteous forsaken, or his seed begging bread. I remember when I first joined the staff of the Moody Bible Institute a number of years ago now, long time ago it seems. They paid me a salary, but I couldn't live on it. It just wasn't enough salary to take care of all the needs. I had four children. By the time I had made my house payment and put food on the table and bought my train ticket into the city, my monthly train ticket, I had nothing left. That's as far as it went. Nothing left. Nothing for shoes, nothing for clothes, nothing for the 101 things that come up in life. We never went without a meal. I don't know where it all came from. Never went without a meal. Kids never went barefoot. Always had warm clothes. We never had to freeze in the wintertime, although we often cooked in the summertime. A marvelous promise of a satisfied life I shall not want. Saved life, he brings back my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness, for his name's sake. His name is bound up with it, you see. If God ever let us down, then the reflection would be upon his name. And he says that he certainly isn't going to bring any reproach upon his own name. The secret of a happy life. I had a friend out in Vancouver, British Columbia, a number of years ago when I first came to Canada. It was a man by the name of John Wilson. He had a little bookstore down a back street in Vancouver. He was a very gifted preacher, full-time Christian worker, bit of a character in his own right. And one day, John Wilson, who was getting on in years himself at the time, he heard somebody say that the devil has no happy old men. So he decided he'd find out if that was true. So for a number of weeks, he made himself a perfect nuisance to old people, asking them if they were happy. He said he never did find a happy old man. He said he helped one old man carry a heavy suitcase up a steep hill. When he put the suitcase down and said, "There you are, sir," shook hands with him. When he had him firmly by the hand, he said, "Tell me, sir, are you a happy man?" Man cursed him to his face. He only found one happy old man. 3 or 4 weeks he tried his experiment. He helped an old blind man across the street. And halfway across, traffic roaring around on every side, he stopped and asked him if he was happy. The man was very happy. Blind old man. Soundly saved and on his way to heaven. The secret of a happy life. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. The secret of a happy death. Now, it's quite obvious, and it's probably been pointed out times without number, but it's worth pointing out again, that in this psalm, as soon as you start into the valley of the shadow, the pronouns change. Up until verse 4, he's talking about the shepherd. The Lord, he says, is my shepherd. He makes me lie down. He leadeth me. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. He's talking about the shepherd. But as soon as he gets in the valley, the shepherd moves a lot closer and he starts talking to the shepherd. Thou art with me. Thy rod, thy staff, thou preparest, thou anointest. He's not talking about him anymore, he's talking to him. That's just exactly what he says, isn't it? When thou passest through the waters, I'll be with you. I'll be with you. The secret of a happy death. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, the shadow of a sword can't kill. The shadow of a dog can't bite. Who's afraid of a shadow? Shadow can't hurt you. Shadow of death can't hurt anybody. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. But where you have a shadow, you have to have two other things you have to have a substance. You have to have a light. It's the light shining on the substance that casts the shadow. So when David talks about the valley of the shadow of death in Psalm 23, it's because he has already talked about the valley of the substance of death in Psalm 22. That's why he can talk about the shadow, because there is a substance. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's the valley of the substance of death. To be abandoned by God for all eternity. That's what the Lord Jesus tasted on the cross of Calvary. He entered into the valley of the substance of death. And as that great hymn says, none of the ransomed will ever know how deep were the waters crossed, nor how dark was the night that the Lord passed through, ere he found his sheep that was lost. There is a substance. There is a dreadful reality. There is that terrible, terrible experience that awaits those who cannot say, the Lord is my shepherd. You can't have a shadow without a substance. If you see the shadow of a dog, you don't have to look far to see the dog. But you also have to have a light before you can have a shadow. In fact, it's the light shining on the substance that casts the shadow. So when you see a shadow, you know that there's got to be a light somewhere, because if there wasn't a light, there wouldn't be a shadow. When I first came to North America, Bank of Montreal sent me out to Vancouver in British Columbia. And I was sitting in a meeting in an assembly out in Vancouver. He was quite a young man. And after the breaking of bread, one of the brethren got up to read a letter. It was a letter addressed to the assemblies by a Dr. Northcote Deck. I worked at Moody Bible Institute for his son-in-law. And he had been a medical missionary, and now he was dying. I believe it was of leukemia. Whatever it was, he knew exactly at what stage his disease was. He knew how far it had progressed, and almost to the day how much longer he had to live. And he wrote a letter, and it was circulated amongst the assemblies in that part of the country. And it was read on that particular Sunday morning in that particular assembly. And in the course of that letter, he made this remark that made a profound impression on me. I never forgot it. Brethren, he said, David speaks of the valley of the shadow of death. I've come into the valley, but there's no shadow. On the contrary, he said, I have found that the path of the just is as a shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day. Now, maybe not every child of God has that experience in the valley, but he certainly did. It's part of the genius of John Bunyan that when Christian and his companion come to the dark river that separates them from where they are and glory on the other side. Is it faithful? I think it was faithful. Was having a marvelous time crossing over Jordan. He says, I can feel the bottom, he says, and it's good. He was having a tremendous time getting over. The poor old Christian was floundering and stumbling and going under and crying out and having a dreadful time. That's part of the genius of John Bunyan. Because not all Christians have that easier crossing of Jordan. But some do. Dr. Northcote Deck said, there's no shadow, just a light. A light shining more and more unto the perfect day. That's the difference, of course, between the death of a believer and the death of an unbeliever. When an unbeliever dies, he goes out into the dark. What the Bible speaks of as the blackness of darkness forever. Nothing could be more terrible than to be forever in the dark. Alone. And afraid. And guilty. But when a Christian dies, he goes out into the light. I am the light of the world, Jesus said. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. I used to puzzle about that. I used to wonder whatever was the significance of the rod and the staff in the valley of the shadow of death. I turned to the commentaries and found, as usual, that they were singularly unhelpful. It's amazing with Bible commentaries how eloquent they can wax over things that you already know all about, and how strangely silent they are on things that you'd like to know something about, and they just seem to let you down. I mean, that's all except the exploring books. And I used to worry about this, and I turned to the commentaries and the best I got, and it wasn't very good, in fact I didn't like it at all, it said that the rod, that the shepherd had a rod and a staff, and the rod was for the back of the sheep, you see. And when a sheep didn't behave itself, it brought the rod down on its back, and that didn't give me much comfort to think that when I got into the valley of the shadow that the Lord was going to be there with a big stick to give me a beating. Sounded too much like a Protestant purgatory. I don't think we have any conception, most Protestants, of the utter darkness of Romanism. There's no more dreadful doctrine than the doctrine of purgatory. And you take a devout Roman Catholic, maybe your neighbor, your friend, somebody you work with, and he's very devout and believes implicitly what his church tells him. There's no hope of heaven, none whatsoever. When he dies, if he dies in what the Catholic Church calls a state of grace, that is, if his penance is all up to date and if he's not got any mortal sin on his conscience, and if he has had the last rites, and he dies in a state of grace with every account settled with the church, then he goes to purgatory. I mean, what could be worse than that? The priest tells him, well, you're a very good Catholic, and you've done everything that the church tells you to do. Now we're going to send you into the fire. It's mockery, really, when you stop to think about it. And there's not a single shred of scriptural warrant for any such teaching, of course. Our God's not like that. It's perfectly true there is a hell for Christ rejecting godless people, but there's no purgatory for God's people. God will not payment twice demand, first at my Savior's pierced hand, and then again at mine. He's not standing there waiting for you at death with a big stick to give you a beating until he's beaten you into some kind of a condition where you can be beatified and eventually canonized. All that's a lot of nonsense. And totally untrue, sad to say. Well, not sad to say, I'm glad it's not true, but sad to say that so many people are deceived into thinking that. Well, the idea of the shepherd standing there with a big stick to give me a thrashing as soon as I get into the valley, as I say, sounded too much like a Protestant purgatory. Some years ago, a Canadian minister by the name of Ken Opperman had an opportunity for a personal interview with Pope Paul VI. It's a very interesting story how he came to have this interview with the Pope, and it was of such a nature that he was treated as a VIP. When he was first asked if he would like to have a personal interview with the Pope, he said, no, thank you. And the Latin American bishop who was arranging for this, it's an interesting story how it all happened. He said, well, why don't you want to see the Holy Father? Well, he said, I have no desire to insult him. Well, he said, how would you insult him? Well, he said, I should refuse to call him Father. And he said, I have no wish to insult the gentleman, so I just do not see him. Well, he said, would you call him Sir? Well, he said, I think I could call him Sir. Well, he said, I'll arrange it on those terms. Well, when he got in, when he got to the Vatican, he was given VIP treatment, and there were all kinds of bishops and cardinals and people hanging around in the vestibule waiting to go in to see the Pope. And here this fella comes in and gets VIP treatment, goes in ahead of all of them. And the Pope, having given the usual greetings and so on, he says, now, Dr. Opperman, he said, is there anything you would particularly like to ask me? Oh, yes, sir, he said, there is something I should like to ask you. Are you saved? And I heard him tell the story at Founders Week at Moody a number of years ago. He said, well, Mr. Opperman, he said, and he explained some kind of a mystical vision he'd had when he was a little boy. It wasn't very satisfactory, so Dr. Opperman rephrased the question. He said, well, tell me, sir, when you die, will you go to heaven? And the Pope looked at this Protestant minister, and he said, ah, Dr. Opperman, you have asked me a very hard question. Oh, you bet it was a hard question. Because if he'd said yes,
he'd have demolished the Catholic Church.
I mean, even the Pope himself doesn't go to heaven when he dies, he goes to purgatory. I mean, what a dreadful religious system. You spend your whole life doing what it says, and in the end, they shove you in the fire. Even if you get to be Pope. Ah, Dr. Apomysius, you've asked me a very hard question. That's a very simple question, wasn't it? When you die, will you go to heaven, yes or no? And then he said, I can remember, he said, his face brightened, and he looked at me, he said, oh, but Dr. Opperman, he said, when I die, I shall have 700 million Roman Catholics praying for my soul. How dark. You see, when a Catholic dies, he goes to purgatory, according to their teaching. Of course, he doesn't go any such place, because there isn't such place. But that's what they teach. And the idea that the shepherd is standing there with a big stick to give me a thrashing when I die, that's too much like a Protestant purgatory. So I rejected that interpretation of the statement. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. What does he mean? That's really very simple, you know. David is thinking of his Exodus. And so, of course, the land of Egypt, the house of bondage, and they came to the waters of the Red Sea that spoke of death. And there stands Moses, and what does he have? In one hand he has a staff, in the other hand he has a rod. And I can see the children of Israel as they march past Moses standing there, and one says to Moses, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me in this place. The waters all piled up around us. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Well, you see, the staff told them that they were just passing through. They were pilgrims. They weren't staying there. They were going over to the other side. The rod, that was for the enemy. Now, when the enemy showed up in that dreadful place, Moses took the rod and he summoned back the sea. The enemy was seen no more. David, thinking of his Exodus, he sees the great shepherd of the sea standing there, a rod and a staff in his hand. You're just a passing through. And don't worry about the enemy. I've already taken care of him. Secret of a happy death. We have, of course, all the light of the New Testament now that David didn't have. And now standing on the other side of the cross, it's much clearer than ever it was before that. We now know that when a Christian dies, it's absent from the body, present with the Lord. What could be better than that? And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Secret of a happy eternity. Our brother McNeil has just come back from Scotland. It's only intensified his brogue, that's the only thing it did for him. Made it more difficult to understand than ever before. Ah, but he knows better than I do what what the name John Knox meant to Scotland. John Knox. Mary Queen of Scots once said she was more afraid of John Knox than she was of all the armies of England. Just a preacher. When John Knox was about to die, some of his friends and his servants gathered around and they asked him for a sign. They wanted to know how a man like John Knox got along as he crossed over Jordan. They asked him for a sign. Would he give them a sign if all was well when he got into the valley? And the poet tells us what happened. Grim, in his deep death anguish, the stern old champion lay, the locks upon his pillow were floating thin and gray. And visionless and voiceless, with quick and labored breath, he waited for his exit through life's dark portal, death. Hast thou the hope of glory? They bowed to catch the thrill that through some languid token might be responsive still. Nor watched they long, nor waited for some obscure reply. Raised a clay-cold finger and pointed to the sky. Thus the death angel found him what time he came that way, to loose the struggling spirit from hampering bonds of clay. Thus the death angel left him what time earth's bonds were risen. A stiff, a cold, stark, stiffening finger, still pointing up to heaven. Happy eternity. Father in heaven, thank you for this great Hebrew hymn, perhaps, written by a teenage lad who had learned the great secret, the greatest secret one could ever learn this side of the Jordan River. The Lord, Jehovah, the I Am, the ever-present one who inhabits eternity and transcends all time. Bless thy people, we pray, for we ask it in Jesus' name.